Welcome to A Cult of Personality, Esoteric Podcast Extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. This is episode 150, featuring Magical Art in the New Aeon, the panel discussion from the 2014 Occult Art Salon in Salem, Massachusetts. The Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section. This episode is also made possible by additional donations from Steve, Lance, and Diana. Thanks again. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. A Cult of Personality podcast is also brought to you by Thelesis Aura, an occult media production, education, and resource company. Publishers of Lon Milo Duquette's Tarot of Ceremonial Magic. Distributors of Kat Luneau's Sacred Imagery. And host to online training and instruction by some of the world's leading teachers of the esoteric arts. For more, visit ThelesisAura.com. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center, located in historic Salem, Massachusetts, offers unique instruction in the arcane arts from some of the most experienced and talented teachers around. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center is committed to the authentic Western esoteric tradition by providing students with quality, in-depth classes along with all the books and ritual tools one could ever want, many of them handcrafted. The ancient mysteries have a new home in the Witch City. Stop by the shop or visit online at hermeticarts.com. On the occasion of the 150th episode, I want to take a moment to thank all the loyal listeners to this show and all the amazing guests. It wouldn't be possible without you. I feel privileged to be able to continue producing this podcast and appreciate the tremendous opportunity it has been to bring you the premier esoteric podcast on the net, and I salute you all. Now, in episode number 150, this recording is from the panel discussion from the second annual Occult Art Salon in Salem, Massachusetts, on Saturday, September 27th, 2014. I moderated the discussion, and the panelists include, in order of appearance, visual and tattoo artist Natan Alexander, the owner of Witch City Inc. in Salem, Massachusetts, and the organizer of the Boston Tattoo Convention. Visual artist K. Lenore Siner. Musician Ron Lolito, a.k.a. Ron Whiskey. Astrologer, performer, and occult art salon organizer April Shaley. Crowley biographer, author, and musician Richard Kaczynski. Performer and healer Aria Michaels Paradise, and Alexandrian High Priest, actor and director, Carrigan Griffith. Links for all the panelists are included in the show notes at occultofpersonality.net. I want to thank all the panelists and the organizers of the Occult Art Salon, especially April Shaley and Sarah Jezebel Wood. And here is Magical Art in the New Aeon.
Thank you very much for coming. I want to also thank April and Sarah and all the organizers of the Occult Art Salon, making such an excellent event for the second year in a row. My name is Greg Kaminsky. I'm the producer of the Occult of Personality podcast. So today our panel discussion is magical art in the new aeon. And I'd like to start, if we could just kind of go down the line, if you could just give a quick introduction with your name. Maybe tell us a little bit about what you like to do creatively, or maybe what your job is that involves creativity. And let's start from there. Natan.
Sure. My name is Natan Alexander. I'm a tattoo artist and painter. I've been tattooing for 20 years. And my tattoos are largely influenced by my interest in magic. My gateway into tattooing was through my desire to live a magical lifestyle and find a way to live as a creative artist to fuel my desire to travel. And I own two shops here on the North Shore, Witch City Ink and Lightwave Tattoos. And I'm in the process of creating a magical retreat center called the Star and Snake in the Lakes region of New Hampshire.
Hi, my name is Kaylin Orsiner, and I'm a painter. My paintings are largely dedicated to bringing forward certain energies or archetypes so they can be seen and more fully understood. My background is in Tantra and in Western shamanic studies.
Cool. Hi, my name is Ron Lolito. I am a musician and psychologist, which is surprisingly creative. Psychology is pretty artistic. I don't get my music, so I don't want to describe it. I really don't quite understand it. And I have a very hard time separating music and magic because they literally happen for me at the same time, which we could talk about as the panel goes. I discovered my first occult book and my first guitar on the same day. Mm-hmm. So it was signs from above. So that's me. Hi.
Actually, I had a similar experience.
Did you really?
Yes. With making, starting to play music, and I started to do that. I retreated into a cabin in Vermont for about a year, in northern Vermont, and lived there with my wolf hybrid for a year. And so when I started to play music from the solitude and dance, and got more of a, I got a natural education from the invisibles. They're being alone and being able to listening. And but I have a master's degree, just formally, I have a master's degree in interdisciplinary art. And I would say that I'm an interdisciplinary artist, but my most recent accomplishments are in belly dance. I travel a lot and teach and perform. And but I also play music, write poems, and take pictures sometimes too. So that's what I do.
My name is Richard Kaczynski. I'm a early biographer, occult historian, and writer. And I find that my writing, whether it be fiction or nonfiction, allows me to be creative. I'm also a musician. And my day job is as a medical researcher, research scientist, and statistician. And even that, I find requires a lot of creative problem solving. There's like a question to answer analytically. So I am blessed to have a lot of creative opportunities in my professional and paraprofessional lives. And since I'm here in Massachusetts in Lovecraft country, I thought it was only appropriate that I...
Yes!
I'm ready.
I can't talk that. My name is Ari Michaels Paradise, and I'm a psychotherapist, currently specializing in bereavement counseling. I'm also a dancer and choreographer. I began as a pianist when I was 5 or 6. I found dance later on. But dance has been the way that I know best thing able to express myself. I began studying different forms of magical inquiry probably about 18 years ago. I kind of excelled and come to 1999. and I like building things and stuff. So I usually incorporate Reiki, the performance magic, in everything that I do. And I really can't distance myself from it. It's a part of every sort of breath I take every day. The way that I look at the world is informed that way.
My name is Garrigan Griffith. I am a professional actor and director. I'm originally from Lisbon, Portugal. Came to the United States 7 years ago. And I am also a high priest of the Alexandrian tradition of witchcraft. I really do blend a lot of my knowledge from theater, as you can imagine, into ritual, and that's what we're going to kind of go into when we do my workshop. But I was born in a family of artists. I remember that I was taking a nap in my grandfather's studio, and I remember that I actually, thinking now, kind of dangerous, smelling the oil painting of the fresh oils that he was painting at the time, and fell asleep on that. I don't know about health issues on that. Maybe that explains a lot for today. I was always very into or brought into art, seeing art. My father's a sculptor, so all of my family was like that. And unfortunately, I didn't go to the School of Arts. I just went to the School of Theater, and they were very upset. But I just see art in everything. So, you know, the pictures, you know, some movement. So for me, it really is constant. As creation is a constant in the world, I just see art as a constant. I see beauty everywhere, which is basically the very nature, I think, of art. So that's basically it. Thank you.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about who the greatest magical influence on your creative work is. Maybe we can start back with Kerrigan.
Oh, well, if you ask any actor, they would tell you that Stanislavski was one of them. And then, of course, if you're talking about America, you're going to go on Lee Strasberg, which is at... many other names, but I think that those are the main ones that I can come up with. In terms of acting, so those are the two main figures I think that I would look at. I also can, you know, I don't know about you, but I feel inspired by others, by other artists, and not only acting artists, but also directors, movie directors, and all of that. So I would say there's only one actress that I look, and it's just having a workshop every time you see a movie of her or with her in it. And that's Meryl Streep, and she is just, she teaches you as she does it, which is very interesting. So I think that those were the three main, you know, aspirations.
Ari?
The original question was on magical influence.
Yeah.
For me, it's difficult to delineate one from the other, which is a question I had with a lot of these artistically and magically. If nothing can be separated, then it's hard to say, well, Verishnikov, he wasn't a magical practitioner, or was he? He doesn't even call himself one, that I'm aware of anyway. Does that make his, the developments that he brought about in the dance world, less significant to a magical practitioner? So if I have to choose a specifically magical influence, which is nature and the cycles and the energies that are always around us. You know, I can just be driving and my winter weather is going, and all of a sudden I go into some trance because I am poetic, but it puts me into this place where I'm seeing the music differently now. So to me, thematically speaking, everything is allowed in because unconsciously it's all there.
That makes sense, yeah. Thank you.
Good.
I guess I'd probably echo a lot of what has been said already, in that I've, in terms of writing or music, I've had a lot of influences or inspirations, but thinking specifically magically, I mean, it's hands down got to be Aleister Crowley. I was directed toward him at a very young age. I had gone into my local occult bookshop, and I had grabbed a copy of Israel Regardi's Golden Dawn. And the owner of the shop saw something in me. To this day, I don't know what it is, but he said, "If you like this, you want to read this book." And he handed me Magic and Theory of Practice, the black Dover paperback edition. And that's the path I got on, and never looked back. So, the second edition of a biography, and lots of other books and articles, and Crowley later. And, it's him.
Can you repeat the question again so that I get, it's the magical influence on the art or the artistic influence?
It's the magical influence on your creative work, but understandably the question can be interpreted differently.
Well, maybe I'm hearing it that way because like Aria was saying, I see they're sort of fused for me, of course. I'm going to go with the first thing that comes to mind for me. And it's my body. It's not another someone. It's my experience of myself. And the natural world. So when I am walking, or I am just being in the natural world, this is when I feel that I'm able to receive what I need to download. And then it swirls around, takes some sort of archetypal form, and then comes out. And as I've matured, I've been able to learn how to be a medial person without it taking me over. When I was younger, this was not so easy for me. So to feel the archetype sort of blooming inside of me and then act it out some way that was maybe non-artistic, And so... it's actually Jungian thought and astrological thought, the archetypes in astrology, and that sort of giving it structure and form and name to what those entities are, and those archetypes and God forms, both maybe, that end up in there and using me to work, gain knowledge of themselves. So that is how I would describe my experience with that. That's what comes up for me with that question.
It's a pattern emerging. So, and I'm going to stick with it. I guess I'd answer it three ways to the sake of honesty. I mean, if we could say that all art is magic, and if we could say that every intentional act is a magical act, your life is a magical act. So I'm not dodging the question though, but I think that, this is what we're picking up on. In terms of music, and I do consider the musicians that have influenced me to be magicians. Debussy is a big influence on me. Bach is a big influence on Antoine Forqueray, Renaissance cellist. Lots of really old, really old musicians. In terms of a magical person, a person in the history of magic who's been a big influence on my art specifically, it would be Kenneth Grant. Not so much his written work necessarily, which includes lots of really creative scholarship, for lack of a better term. But what he did with his life, what he did with his group that he worked with, and how they decided not to simply repeat a formula, but to do something quite different with it, and to focus on the use of the body in Kenneth's words, derangement of the senses, to invite spirit and art into the person. I'd also echo, you know, it's funny, I'm sorry, I forgot your name already. Hi, Eric. You mentioned windshield wipers, and windshield wipers is like the number one source of music inspiration for me. It is, you know, natural world, obviously, but the so-called unnatural world too. You know, this kind of like
right.
mellotronish hum of the air conditioner back there. You know, that's great. That's great influence for musical creativity. For me. So, you know, I wanted to be fair and honest and answer all those aspects. But I think that's going to be the thing that we're seeing. I think most, probably everyone here thinks of themselves as an artist in some way. I hope you do. And, you know, most, I think most artists are going to give you the same response. You just don't separate these things. Spiritual experience is artistic experience and vice versa. That's your spiel.
I really loved reflecting on this question because it brought me back to a real turning point in my artistic practice. And so the names that came up for me were Ken Eaglefeather and Carlos Castaneda, both of whom studied with Don Juan. And through reading their writings, I started to get a real technology in connecting to different states of consciousness, whether it be through sleeping states, astral travel, through different meditations, through the whole Toltec idea of moving the assemblage point and changing perception. And while I was doing that reading and studying and playing with that, I was doing a lot of painting. And the overlap in it allowed me to start to see how my process in painting and how the work itself started to work with my assemblage point, work with my awareness, and create this dialogue back and forth. And for me, it's really what opened up the idea for me as a painting or art as a portal to another dimension and an ability that it has to shift our energy. So that was really life-changing for me.
I grew up without television. I had the woods and I had books. My mother was a Jehovah's Witness and still is. And I began to have a sort of spiritual descent around 10 or 11 or 12. And it corresponded with a number of dreams and visions I was having of visitations. And they terrified me because I'd been taught to believe that these were demons and they were coming and trying to pull me away from God. At the same time, I had started running to overcome asthma and chronic pneumonia. And the combination of these visions along with the sort of meditational space I was achieving through running started making me listen a little bit more to those sort of voices. I left home at 16 and started working and started voraciously collecting an assemblage of authors around myself. At that time, they were primarily voices of spiritual descent. So Anton LaVey, Marquis de Sade, you know, H.P. Lovecraft, you know, all of these sort of sinister figures had a very big pull on me. And it wasn't until I got my first real book on magic, which was Peter J. Carroll's Leave It All in Psychonaut, that I started hearing some clarity in all that. When I first contacted Crowley, who's of course been a major influence, it was just confusing. I couldn't understand it. I didn't have the educational background for it. So it was really Peter Carroll's Leave It All in Psychonaut that gave me the courage to say, I'm going to just start creating the life that I want. And when I finally took that step, I left the country. I moved to a foreign country and discovered the company of artists who were tattoo artists. They were travelers. They were magicians. They were artists. And that's where I found myself in this sort of like band of gypsies and started getting influenced primarily by the people who were tattooing me. And every time that sort of resonance, that kind of connection, getting tattooed by an individual would leave a permanent connection to them in the terms of their marks upon my body. And so I could name a bunch of people that no one in this room knows. But they're the people who contributed to the body of art that I carry in myself.
What is your opinion of applying concepts of time to movements within art or poetry, prose, or any type of creativity? know classification seems to make sense, but sometimes creative works seem to defy our efforts to put them in a box. So this question is really designed around the concept of ages or aeons or ways of segmenting things by time, essentially. So what's your opinion of that generally?
Well, I mean, the concept of eons, you know, or eon, however you want to say it, is something that's redolent in magical literature. I personally think that it's about stages of personal progression. I like to look at it through that lens more. And I'm going to take it back to Tattoo Land because that's the world that I inhabit. When you journal on your skin, you begin to keep a connection to things that had meaning for you through various periods and parts of your life. And you're constantly in relation to that. You're not allowed to let it just slip away in time because it's a part of you. It becomes the fabric of your being. And you look down on it and you see, well, this is what I believed in then. This is who I was, and this is the way that changed over time. And that defines your relationship to many, many things, all the sorts of things that people put in their bodies. So I know this is a bit of a divergence from that, but you know, if our bodies are the vehicle that we're traveling through, and I'm thinking about time as often glyphed as an arrow, right? This, our body is our vehicle, it's our ba, right? Right? Traveling down that river of time, and in, we're storing all that knowledge, all of that information. And so for me as an artist, my idea of time, when I think of time, I think about how we mark ourselves and it's there forever. As long as you have this body, you're going to have that mark. And I try to think about that when I'm connecting people to their symbols, let them know, listen, man, you're going to have a relationship with this for the rest of your life. So really think carefully.
The question again, Greg, is the relevance of categorizing?
Just sort of what's your opinion about it, categorizing things this way, and how that relates to the idea of a new age or a new aeon?
I think putting art into categories, it's convenient as a reference point so we can understand each other when we're talking about basic movements in art. And I think that it's always slightly irrelevant in the present moment. When it comes to art making, I don't think that the categories really create any structure. I think most of the categories of art are created afterwards, and I think that's the same way that we look at eons. Like, I've only been in this present moment, and I'm understanding the past through this present moment, and so I'm titling the past, but I don't think that they're actually real moments. I think it's just a matter of us terming things so we can understand them and discuss them.
Just a matter of context and relationship.
Yeah, and convenience, so it can communicate.
Well, as a magus, I exist outside the circles of time. It's a joke. people talk about this aeonic thing, and what part of the question was movements in art, and part of the question was this idea of a new age and these different aeons of time, especially in sort of Thelemic magic. I agree with both Tom and Kay said, you know, that first you have to see those things, I think, as internal processes. I always think, when people talk about aeons, I always think about Walt Whitman. He said, what did he say? I contain multitudes, I believe is what he said. I think he meant that in a slightly different context, but I always think about that. You know, I contain aeons. I think of that sort of this idea of the procession of aeons as formula. You know, it's the sort of tetragrammaton of how do I make this thing work? You know, I'm trying to meet spirit. I always think in terms of spirit. I'm trying to meet spirit halfway. You know, spirit has made the first move and said, "Hey, you know, here I am." And I'm trying to figure out, okay, well, what do I have to do? What's the formula so I can sort of meet you halfway and get there? Getting to the part of the question about categories, Of course, yeah, they're useful for communication, and I'm very much with you on that. But I think that's really it. You know, that's all. Because all spiritual experience is new. Spirit is always a virgin. We're gonna be blessed with a ritual on Sunday that has something to do with a spirit coming down and then being raised up, and that's all. She's called Virgo Intacta because all spiritual experience every time it's new, and I don't separate spiritual experiences from creative moments. They're the same thing for me. It's nice to have a language, you know. Is this a Baroque piece? Is this a, postmodern piece? Is this found music? You know, that kind of thing. But that's just to talk. You know, that has very, very little to do with both the experience of creating, but more importantly, that experience that you have of sharing that with people, and they somehow magically get it. You know, somehow you feel the same thing I'm feeling because of this shared creative experience. I don't think that you can put that in a box. You can put labels on it so that we can chat, but we should always remember that that's all we're really doing, because each one is new.
Well, we were actually in my astrology workshop just now. We were talking about a lot of this stuff because, spending so much time with astrology, I look at things from that perspective often, or perspectives, astrologies. And astrology has a planet, a entity, or I'm not sure what I would call it, but like there's lots of ingredients to what makes up a whole. And so there is Saturn, who is the definer, time, space, organization, structure. And in order for us to all get along and talk to one another, like everyone's saying here, there needs to be some sort of definition. You know, like we just did when we started. I do this. You know, I do that. That's who I am. Yet our life purpose, I think, is revealed to us each and every second that we're going, like you were saying, Virgo Intacta, right? It's perpetually unfolding and brand new moment. Yet there are zeitgeists that happen. And that, so there's a spirit of the time. And you know it when you're in it. And there are transpersonal planets in astrology that, if you can read them, you can see what they're, it's a language. There's something that they're saying about that generation. The planet stays in one sign, in one spot even, for years and years. And everyone who's born at that time has that planet in that sign. And the astrology is just the map. It's the reflection. But that's the reflection that, if you're looking at that map, that you're seeing, is that that's the zeitgeist for that moment, for that generation. And then that reveals itself in every moment, too. The new aeon, we're finding out what that's meaning as it's unfolding in this moment. And I think that as artists, I don't know if everyone has this experience, but sometimes I'll just feel a pressure inside of me that I know that there is that spirit is moving into me. It's not just my personality. You know, it's something that is here for this time and this moment that is bringing in a something that's collective and not just the April Shaley show, you know? So, that's what I want to say about with my experience of that is things that come to mind for me. Yeah.
No.
I think, from an intellectual standpoint, the idea of defining movements or understanding artistic movements in terms of a time period and, puts them into the context in which they were created, and that can be useful. But I think ultimately anyone who is doing creative work doesn't want to be in a box. box, you know, and ultimately those sorts of labels can be limiting. I think one of my favorite stories at this point deals with the astronomer Tycho Brahe, who, you know, was, you know, walking home from this observatory at one point, and he was like, struck that there was something wrong in the sky. He couldn't quite put his finger on what it was, and just like stopped some farmer on the road as he was walking along and said, "You see something weird up there?" And I can't quite put my finger on it. And the farmer said, "Yeah, there's a new star." And his whole idea was, if you're, he was like in this, steady state view of the cosmos, and the idea that a new star could emerge was more than he could, grasp. And so seeing it was something that somebody struggled with, whereas the, the uneducated country bumpkin was like, I didn't have those blinders on. And I think it's kind of the same way with art. We all want to think outside that box. One of the pieces I played last night was a composition by the OTO founder Henry Klein. And it's a piece that, to me, sounds a lot like David C's work, Clair de Lune and that kind of stuff. But this was written 50 years before that, And if someone wants to do, 20th century music, does that mean they have to, they can't use a key signature, or they have to throw out bar lines, mm-hmm. and it has to be atonal? The idea is you can throw out the rules, but then you can pick and choose the ones that you want to use as it suits you. And I think that's, that's what we all want to do creatively. I mean, I recently finished writing a novel, and it's the fun thing is I have a real hard time saying what genre it fits into, because it really doesn't fit into a genre, which makes it kind of hard to pitch it to somebody. But at the same time, it's very satisfying to feel like I did feel constrained and have to go down a particular trope. But as far as this whole idea of eons goes, again, it's useful to a point. But, we need to be careful about getting locked into it, particularly this idea of a new eon, it's been the eon of Horus for 110 years, it's been the age of Aquarius for 50 years, at some point, it's not that new anymore, and so what do we do with that, at some point, it's the slightly used eon. I don't know what it would be, but, we have to be ready to grow, with our experiences as we grow. Thank you.
I like this question because every time I think about it, I come up with a different response. If I am the viewer of art, none of us exist in a vacuum. I can only perceive art from, as you were able to say, like the zeitgeist that I was born into. Likewise, the art that I am viewing was created in their specific zeitgeist. So that relationship, in some ways, is timeless. In some ways, it defines time and defines kind of the relation of time. When I'm creating a choreography, usually what happens is I'm a conduit, so that something is sort of shown to me, and it's my job to interpret that to the audience so they can see what I'm now seeing. Depending on the audience, I usually try and use a very linear approach to time, because that's what we're used to. We're used to Terra Manager theory, we all have calendars in Washington, clocks everywhere, and it allows us to feel stable. It allows us to feel safe. And when you are showcasing a piece of art, music, dance, whatever, you want the audience to trust you so that they will enter that space. If the audience doesn't trust you, they won't want to enter it because it's scary. I like to destabilize my audiences a bit, but usually not with time. I allow for linearity of time, that approach, to allow the audience in, and then I can disable and come in. So, I do think that our consciousness exists outside of ourselves. we, you know, there's all sorts of theories and concepts that I won't get into. But our conception of time is very limited. So, as artists, we try not to be limited, but also try to, allow our audience to engage with us. So for me, that approach of using a linearity approach helps to, engage the people that I'm working with.
Without the box, we don't know what is outside the box. One of the most interesting things that an audience can experience, it's the loss of time in the history of story that it's being told by the actors. That is a moment that can be also experienced in dance or in painting or in music. Any kind of, you know, I wanted to tell you, because you told me, you know, I have all of these things in my, this is me, I carry it with me, my story. You have a book of life, your life, and you. You are that. If you look at it and you can see it. I just love when art is ephemeral. I just love it. You know what I mean? Because that is when it's really precious. Because that is, that was you playing the piano last night. It was an amazing moment that cannot be reproduced by, I mean, we can record it. Is it the same thing? No. Because what I experienced by listening to you and that particular moment, it's what really makes it special. So, of course, we all have tags and stuff. We need boxes. We need things to point it out. Oh, that's, you know, price. And, you know, of course. But I think that that is more... You know, I heard that, you know, if you dominate time, you dominate the universe. And it's really, you know, you don't, there is no time. This is a concept that it's really very human-like. We really want that. Is it scary? Not having time is scary. You don't know where you're going. What do you mean I don't know where you're going? I have to know where I'm going. And that's why we are told that we need those boxes and we need to categorize things like that. But I don't like it. Really don't. I think it gets in the way of the creative process. I don't think that the cubists, for instance, knew that they were doing, you know, that then would be something that would influence that. But they were in the moment.
Right.
That's what it is. Artists go in the moment. That is how it is. You play the piano, you're in the moment. You're dancing, you're in the moment. You know, that's it. If you're preoccupied, oh, I'm doing, you know, classic, you know, cross with whatever, it's spontaneity. It just goes out of the, you know, there's no, so I don't like boxes. We need them. Hopefully we don't have them when we do art. And that's it.
So this next question, I think, kind of trying to incorporate some of your answers here. And when I think about the new Aeon, I think a lot about the Book of the Law, written by Crowley. And one of the things that stands out to me is the way that the text is kind of, at certain points, referencing things that came beforehand, whether it's Kabbalistic ideas or earlier religions or other archetypes or whatnot. And I think part of what is happening there is it's invoking these older ideas in order to set itself apart, but also to say that, you know, that it is in this stream of philosophies or ideas, but yet it's different. And one of the ways in which the new challenges the old is through opposition to normative values. And I'm wondering about your opinion on this strategy, whether it's related to art or, you know, whatever kind of creative process, challenging the old, building something new. Do you find value in that? Do you find value in upholding existing traditions, both, neither? You know, what are your thoughts around that?
Well, I think that that's very interesting. You know, I'm thinking about Alexander's. He was like, he completely just blowed everyone out of the box. we're talking about boxes at the time, and he was very much a showman, as everybody knows. They didn't like him at all. And he, again, he took the structure of the old. We're talking about Gardner and Ridgecraft, so he took that structure and he built it upon it with a lot of other elements, you know, from Golden Dawn, from Ceremonial Magic, here, there, you know, he got Kabbalah, you know, all of those things. I don't know if we can create something, you know, if you want to continue to do something in those lines, and that's the reference that we said, well, it's referencing, it's setting itself apart, but at the same time, it's referencing where it is in space and time, maybe. You do need that structure. Not necessarily, but you do need it. And so truly amazing when you go against everything. Truly amazing. Those are the best, you know, creative processes in the world, in history, with those guys that said, you know, we are actually going around the sun, guys. This is not what you think. So that guy, incredible, huh? That was against. So that's what I think. Yes, you do. You have a basis. And I think that the most incredible moments happen when you just go against everything. And there's always one or two or three, and hopefully hundreds of us doing that. You know what I mean? Not necessarily to be recognized, but to just push things. You know what I mean?
Thank you.
I think that in order to be an effective artist, you have to have a lot of tension in you between old and new, and you have to feel discontent. Complacency is the enemy of art. So with regard to, again, the question of structure, when I'm in that sort of creative process, I'm not consciously, intentionally creating. Because if I am, I'm doing it wrong. I need to interpret what, I can't talk about it there. I need to interpret what I'm seeing against the audience. The less I put of my will, with the capital W, the better. Now sometimes what I'm seeing might be incomplete. So I need to incorporate some of something that seem organic to the process. But in terms of having earlier traditions, I mean, if I for me the music informs what I will be offering. If it's something very classical, I will probably be going back to my ballet roots. And it may not be specifically the light movement, but the structure of the staging and the characters will be much more formalized than if I'm doing something that's more modern. So again, for me, I appreciate the fact that we need structure and we need to be able to categorize things so that we can tell, well, I'm doing this piece and it looks like this. But unconscious approaches to art don't allow us to put those in intentionally. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. You know, you started your question by referencing, you know, Crowley in the Book of the Law. And I think when you talk about somebody like Crowley, there's no question that he was, like, rebelling and reacting against, you know, his upbringing and society in which he lived. And, you know, and you certainly see aspects of that in the Book of the Law as well. I mean, no existence, you know, is not sorrow. Existence is pure joy, you know, things like that. But at the same time, I think it's clear when you look at, like, you know, Crowley's work that, you know, even though he felt that, you know, Thelemos, like, superseded what had gone before, it wasn't necessarily erasing
what had happened before. There's a real interesting letter when Crowley, like in his late 60s, you know, going on 70, and he wrote to William D. Crow, kind of talking about what the new eon means. He's basically saying, I don't know what the new eon means. You know, I think some of the rituals, like, you know, Liber Reguli, are kind of pointing the way, but you know, he's saying, I was born in the old eon. You know, someone else has to figure this stuff out. And I, myself, for practical uses, still have to use the Osirian formulas. So clearly, those things still work in the new eon. It's just, you know, there's something else. You know, and I suppose in that sense, I kind of think of, you know, the idea that the philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, came up with in his book on the nature of scientific revolutions. And the whole idea of a paradigm shift, you know, and he's the one who coined that term. It's kind of become an overused cliche, but, you know, that what he meant in its original sense is that there are times when our understanding of the universe fundamentally shifts. And when that shift happens, it doesn't, again, the test of a new paradigm isn't that it wipes out what has gone before, is that it explains what's been gone before, but also explains a bunch of new data that you couldn't also explain, because you're seeing the world in a bigger way. And, you know, again, I think that's kind of a good place to go, again, if you're a creative person. Myself, again, I think there's a lot to be gained from, like, reacting against something, so you're kind of pushing boundaries, and creatively, in art, that's a good thing. But I think at the same time, as long as you're reacting against something, you're still kind of a slave to that something that you're pushing against. And, you know, there's something liberating in saying, you know, I'm letting go of this thing that has power over me. You know, I think I remember having that experience, though, when I was at my father's funeral. You know, I had, you know, I was, you know, he was a Catholic, and because I was the son, I was, you know, there in the front row, and had to, you know, participate in the ceremony. And I was like, oh man, I've like moved so beyond this. I don't want to go up there and take communion and blah blah blah. And I got, you know, I had this moment of clarity where I thought, you know, I've gone to, you know, magical rituals, santeria rituals, you know, Jewish ceremonies, Hindu pujas, the whole thing, and I was like open to this. Why should I be equally open to this? Why is this kind of, why am I like feeling, you know, at, you know, wanting to keep this at arm's distance? And it was just like, it's like, you know, that, like in Labyrinth, we have no power over me. And it was a real liberating moment.
Listening to is making me think also of, we're talking about this earlier also in the workshop, of the shadow, that when you are rejecting anything, even if it's your previous upbringing or the old aeon or whatever it is, as soon as you do that, you turn it into shadow, and then it's gotcha, you know? And then it runs you, and you can consciously be like, oh, like, I'm all new aeon, you know? and then you're still acting all like old aeon, because it's really your shadow self. It's the unconscious self that's actually going to run you. So, yeah, you kind of have to reintegrate the things that there's a season for everything. And I think maybe in our younger lives, there's a season for saying, no, I am not that. Those are not my rules. I'm going to be this. Then you hit a certain point in your life where you realize that you've done that so much, you've become the thing. You've become just like your mother, you know? This is not what you meant to do at all, even though you're wearing completely different clothes, you've got a different boyfriend, and you never got married, and, you know, whatever it's going to be. And so, so there's that danger with doing that kind of thing. On the other hand, in dance, we say a lot, you need to know the rules to break the rules. You can't really innovate, and you can't really break new ground if you don't know what's come before you. You don't respect what's come before you. So like in Middle Eastern dance, for instance, some would say it's imperative that you understand the cultural roots that this comes from. You understand what the history of it is, why this dance from Egypt made it over to Western world, and what the context is of that, and then your place in that whole scenario, and and that gives you context for what you're doing. And then you can break all those rules and do something right. different, but you know what you're talking about, at least, you know? So there's that. And then one more thing I wanted to say about this idea is that sometimes in art making, this is sort of what Kerrigan was saying, you need to know the box to know what's outside of the box. I think that it's like, I think of like these challenges that they're there. Record an album in 1 month and show it to everyone, you know? That's definition. You know, this is just getting back to the other question a little bit, but that's definition right there. And that prompt should actually make some shit. As opposed to like, no form, and I'm not in a box, and, you know, I'm not anywhere, really. I'm just having a fantasy of myself as an artist, and maybe someday I'll do something. I'll just dream. You know, when you have structure, and you have what's happened before you, and you have the challenge of challenging what's happened before you, and you know the rules, and you know who did what, and you know you've got this amount of time and space to get this done, then that impetus comes, you feel your daemon, and you do your stuff, and then it's got form, boom, and it's art, you know? So these things work, I think there's all different voices that we're listening to within ourselves to create this alchemical reaction that then becomes, this is what I'm going to call art.
If it's okay, I want to take a little bit of a slightly different nuance to the question. There's been some talk about tradition, structure, revolutions, particularly in science. You know, not liking the cool new guy. You know, the prophets never listened to in his own country, and so on. And rather than talk about my thoughts on what I guess you call a creative process, but you know what's the function of art? And I don't want to be ridiculous. I like to be ridiculous sometimes. I was going to say something like, all art is transgressive, you know, because that sounds really dramatic and so forth. I don't know that it is, but my favorite art is transgressive.
Yeah.
And I think often that's the role art plays in the world. You know, if we talk about, you know, movements in history and zeitgeist and so on. There's this great book, not to put my shrink hat on, but there's this great book called Better Angels of Our Nature, written by psychologist Steven Pinker. Great book. If you haven't checked it out, please do. It's really all about the history of violence in the human race and how remarkably civilized we really are under the circumstances. We sort of live in a culture where, because we have such quick access to news and so forth, maybe we see the world as a lot more dangerous than it really is. We're really remarkably civilized as a species. And a lot of what he attributed these civilizing factors to is art. For example, in the Industrial Revolution, we stopped sending five-year-olds to work with a bottle of gin and say, good luck, dude. See you in 14 hours. Why? And that's true. And his argument, which is very compelling, is because of Oliver Twist. You know, it's art that changes the world. It's art that says, okay, time for something new, time for a new age, time for a different way to look at this. And that's one of the functions of art, I think, you know, for us, is to be transgressive and to shake things up. You know, we had this really long, nerdy conversation about progressive rock today, because we always talk about progressive rock. And I love that old, pretentious 70s overblown stuff, but I also love the fact that punk rock came around and just shook it up and said, fuck you, you know, no more, one chord, you know. And we need that. And so I think a lot of times the function of art is to be transgressive and to create that change by, you know, turn its back on tradition a little bit.
In answering this question, I heard people bring up the word against a lot. Like, Kerrigan, you were using the word, like, acting out against the environment around you, the artistic environment. And for me personally, the artistic process is about not being against anything, but rather being really deeply with myself. So what does that mean in terms of tradition versus innovation? Because that's really how I, you know, sort of synthesized your question. And coming from this place of being deeply with myself in the artistic process, I have to say that it's both. solitarily in my studio by myself. I am solo, and then I also have the, you know, that ancestral memory of seven generations in myself. I am with all of them. I can say that I'm not looking at any other art, and I'm, you know, just being totally in my own process, but really just walking out on the street and seeing fashion or advertising, whatever, it's influencing me. And that current influence is on the shoulders of everything that came before it. So I think that for me, the artistic process is really finding a balance in that, to be able to hear what's coming through in the swimminess of the past meeting the present moment.
Still taking in everything everyone brought to this. To me, the formula of the opposer, adversary, this idea of against, it's an essential dichotomy. It's a circle that's continuously going around. The Luciferian gnosis is the awareness of being in that cycle. And rather than fearing it, rather than submerging it, it's bringing it forward and bathing in its light. What that looks like for the individual is the need to constantly reinvent oneself. And it's essentially what we're doing every time we pick up a brush or we pick up a pen or we stand in front of an instrument or in front of a group of people. We're reinventing ourselves. When people come into my studios, you know, very often they're looking for some sort of act of rebellion of some kind. They're looking, I mean, it sounds like such a cliche, but, you know, they're all rebelling by looking exactly the same. You know, everyone's marking their bodies with some act of personal transgression. You know, just to reference Libernol again, there was a quote that stuck with me through my early years that was, the only clear view is from atop a mountain of your dead selves. And in that sense, I think that transgression in the opposer is incredibly healthy. And I support all the little rebels. As a father, I see it emerging in the budding will of my son, and I say, yeah, dude, go for it. And at some point, you're going to need to kill me, and that's cool.
So I want to just again take a moment to thank all the panelists for bringing such well-thought-out, eloquent answers to these questions, and I think making it all of us think a little bit more about it. And there are no real easy answers about any of these things, which makes it so wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
Greg, can I thank you, Father Socrates, for the art of questioning.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, subscribers can listen to a presentation on inner alchemy that was recorded at the Hermetic Arts Learning Center in Salem, Massachusetts, on the evening of November 14, 2014, along with an additional offer for subscribers to participate in an ongoing series of online classes about inner alchemy. Membership provides access to a tremendous archive of additional interviews and teachings for a low monthly fee while helping to support the production and distribution of the show. Join now to receive access to all the exclusive content.